Welcome to Understand Suicide, the podcast of journalist and therapist Paola Fontanelli. Since her father's suicide in 2005, Paola has dedicated her life to breaking the silence around this most stigmatized of subjects. Her book, Understanding Suicide, Living with Loss, Paths to Prevention, was nominated for the National Book Award in Brazil, and the English edition is now available on Amazon.
Hello, everyone. Here we are again on my podcast and my YouTube channel. And today, for the first time in the history of this podcast, I am repeating a guest because she deserves it. You might have listened to the first interview with Stacy Friedenthal. We talked about her book, How to Help Suicidal, was it patients or the first one?
Helping the Suicidal Person, Helping Tips the suicidal. And Techniques for Professionals.
Yes, so that was the first book. And the reason why we decided to do this again is that she has a new book out. And I am telling you, I could not put it down. I usually, when I read a book for the podcast, depending on what the book is, I just skim through it. In her book, I actually had to say, okay, stop, because I didn't have that much time that day. So I have to finish this. I have to prepare the interview. But there were so many good stories, so many good tips in the book. And this one, the difference between this one and the first one is that this one is for the general public. So it's for you who have a loved one, a friend, a partner, family member who is suicidal, actively or not. And it's written for you. The first one was more for clinicians, even though I think for the general public, it's very helpful as well. And I have to say, Stacy, when you told me you have one for the general public, I was wondering how on earth is she gonna do this? Because the other one was already so good and so relatable. But then I started reading your book and say, is she just going to kind of spin around on what she already wrote? Because it was so complete and very easy to understand. So it was for the general public as well. But then I started reading your book and I have to congratulate you. You did it again. You wrote
an excellent
book. And this one is even more relatable than the first one, because this one, I find, correct me if I'm wrong, but it has more stories. So for me, I've had friends who were suicidal, and of course my father was suicidal, and I saw myself in so many stories. And that's what's great about this book. You are going to read it and you're going to say, yeah, that's me. Yes, that's how I feel. Yeah, I've been through that. Or maybe I'm here or there, but that's what I loved about your book. First of all, the title. I love the title, and we know how hard it is to come up with titles with suicide, right? Because we don't want to be triggering and all of that. So the title of this one is Loving Someone with Suicidal Thoughts, What Family, Friends, and Partners Can Say and Do. So the loving someone with suicidal, how on earth did you come up with that idea? I want to know. Well, welcome to the podcast again.
Thank you very much for having me, Paola. It's a delight. I enjoy talking with you. So it's funny, though, about the title is I had nothing to do with it.
Really? It's tough, isn't it? It's always been the toughest for me. Even articles come up with a headline. I always ask someone, can you just help me with that? I don't think I can do it. It's really tough. Yeah.
Well, in this case, they already had a series of books. Like they had Loving Someone with ADHD, mm-hmm. Loving Someone with Bipolar Disorder, Loving Someone with, I don't remember, I think it's eating disorders, but it may have been one of the names of the eating mm-hmm. disorders. Mm-hmm. And so they approached me and said, we'd like to talk mm-hmm. with you about writing this book called Loving Someone with Suicidal Thoughts. And I thought, I love that title.
Yeah, it is.
It immediately worked for me.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I love the titles. And let me just give my listeners, and if it's YouTube, my subscribers, an idea of the topics that you cover. So I'm just going to go through quickly some of the chapters. I am a content page kind of person. When I get a book, I go straight to the content page and I say, okay, should I continue or not? But It's very important. So you talk about your loved one's suicidality and you, and we're going to cover that one because I really love that chapter. Managing your stress, fear, and guilt. Brave listening, asking difficult questions. That's a great one too. Getting help, building safety after a suicide attempt, which is very important. We're talking about suicidal thoughts, so it can happen, right? So what if it happens? Coping with conflict. And one that I really loved that you addressed was if you feel manipulated. That one really caught my attention because sometimes, so many times I've heard people say, that's just manipulation. They're just trying to get attention or they're just trying to get their way. So they manipulate. And of course, sometimes we're humans, it happens. But I love that you addressed that because it's a very common question and misconception, right? So much so that it's kind of within the scope of myths, right? If they talk about it, they really don't mean to do it. Right. It's one of the myths about suicide. So so many good topics here, but we have to start somewhere. So we are going to start with your loved one's suicidality and you, and I'm going to read something you wrote that really spoke to me. Your own troubles don't magically disappear just because someone appears to have it worse than you. And that is so important. I want to hear you talk about that. Why did you choose that?
Yeah, I think, you know, to me, there were kind of like these two parallel purposes to the book. And one was people want concrete advice on what do I say, what do I do? If somebody I love or somebody I care about, it doesn't have to be that you love the person, but, you know, if somebody I know has suicidal thoughts. And the parallel purpose of the book to me is the toll it takes on the person doing the helping. You know, it's stressful. And I talked about this in the book for professionals, too, but I think even more so for family and friends. Because professionals, you know, they see a client for 50 minutes, maybe 100 minutes, maybe 150 minutes a week. But friends and family, they see people late at night when they're in total despair or when they're drunk or when they're not getting out of bed in the morning, you know, so they're seeing them day to day being challenged. They're seeing their loved one be challenged and they're being challenged.
Yeah, yeah. And they have to deal with all the emotions that come with it, right?
Oh, yeah. And that's, sorry, I had to take a sip of water. I appreciate your bringing up the chapters about conflict and manipulation because those, I think, are some of the things that cause people the most stress. I mean, obviously, the thing that causes the most stress is this person I know could die.
Right, yeah.
You know, I mean, that's huge. But then people can start feeling really stressed and sometimes guilty or hard on themselves about feeling angry. You know, feeling angry at the person for whatever challenges their suicidality presents. Those two chapters were really hard to write because I had to hold two people in mind, the person with suicidal thoughts and the person who cares about them, and they have different needs and attitudes. So like I would write something and then I would think, oh, but
what will that perspective, like, yeah.
Yeah, like what will it be like for this person to read it? And so then I would, you know, try to shape it a little more. And then it was like, but what will it be like for this person to read it? You know, so those two were very challenging.
It's a tough, and I was actually curious that when I went, and we'll talk more about that, I'll cover that. But when I went straight to the manipulators, how is she approaching this? Because this is such a hard topic to approach. And you did a great job. We'll go there. But for now, I want to stay and to cover some of the emotions that you talk about in this chapter, okay? Let's start with, and sometimes, as you said, they are conflicting. You can be sad and angry at the same time, right?
Yeah.
you can be compassionate and again and angry at this person because they're making you go through that, right? And again, when you feel manipulated, we'll go there. But let's start with sadness. And I'm going to read something. You gave an example of a mother. And this, I'm sure that a lot of mothers out there who are listening will relate to this. She says, "I brought him into this world, and it shatters me that he wants to leave it." That's so powerful. And the sense of responsibility. I mean, for parents, it's, wow, it's really difficult. So can we talk about sadness? How else does it show up?
Sadness can be about so many different things. I mean, for the parents, often there's a sense of, I must have done something wrong. Mm. You know, how could...
So you're sad at yourself too? Like a sense of failure?
Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. Sad about oneself, and also sad that that the parent mm-hmm. may be sad that they did bring this person into the world and the person's suffering. You know, so I brought them into this world, and now look what it's mm-hmm. leaving them with. You know, and some of the things that I try to talk about in the book are, some things might seem small, you know, like there's sadness about, oh my gosh, I love this person. I don't want them to die. And I'm sad that they are in so much pain, or that they are facing so mm-hmm. many problems, or so much stress, or so much trauma, so much mental illness, whatever mm-hmm. the case is, that they want to die. But then there also could be sadness of, like, there was I can't remember which chapter it was in, but the woman who was getting married, and the night before she got married, her sister attempted suicide. Mm. And it's like, it was my special day. I was getting married.
Yeah, it ruined it, right? Yeah.
Right. You know, so sadness can be, you know, on the scale of life and death. And it can also be on the scale of, oh my God, I have to leave work again because there's a crisis. And, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you know, and I've only gotten 4 hours of sleep because of the crisis or the different crises. Mm-hmm. And so it, you know, it can be very big picture, and it also can just be, you know, kind of practical things.
Yeah. And the other thing I was thinking, you're talking now, and I was thinking about also the sadness that you don't even allow yourself to feel, which is for your losses, right? Because all of these that you just mentioned, these are losses, and your life changes, and you're always anxious, always yes. worried, and you don't go to the movies anymore because everything now is about this person. And there's so many, like, it's grief, right? You're going through this grief. And many, the importance of you being able to take care of yourself, because there is a huge loss for you as well. But we don't give ourselves that space, because again, as you, the example that I gave before, that's minor, that I'm not going to the movies anymore compared to what they're feeling. But still, it's your life. Right? So you have to give yourself, be graceful, I mean, give yourself grace for that, and give yourself time to be even sorry for your loss too. It's not just the person who is losing.
I'm going to say something, and it might sound weird. So mm-hmm. when I was in my 20s, I had a friend whose mother was diagnosed with breast cancer. And this isn't even related to suicide, but it just mm-hmm. seems parallel. Her mother was diagnosed, let's say it was a Thursday, and my friend was going into town, you know, her mother lived out of state, that Friday, like the very next day, and she got a call that her mother had breast cancer, and my friend was crying, you know, we were in our 20s, she was crying, mm-hmm. she was all upset, I'm too young for my mother to die, I love my mother, I don't want her to die, and then she said, and it's my birthday on Saturday.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I said, what? And she said, it's my birthday, and all the focus is going to be on her because of her breast cancer. Mm. And I just loved her so much in that moment for being so human.
Human, yeah. Yeah.
You know, like, a lot of people won't admit that, yeah. you know, that there's, but she did, and she was thinking of herself. And you know, there was the big picture loss of, oh, mm-hmm. my God, my mother could die. And then there was the, I don't know what you want to call it, kind of the smaller issue loss mm-hmm. of, Oh, and now we're not going to have fun celebrating my birthday.
Yeah. We went through this during the worst times of the pandemic, remember? That people were saying, well, what's the big, people are dying. Why are you sad? Because you're not graduating.
Right.
Remember? Or weddings that had to be canceled. And people are like, oh, but look at this. People are dying. You shouldn't be worried. That's so selfish. And at some point, we started talking about this. Listen, we're all going through grief. We're all losing something. There's a lot of loss around. So let's respect everybody's losses.
Well, and one person's grief doesn't cancel out another person's. Mm-hmm. You know, so if one person, God forbid, I'm just saying this as an example, mm-hmm. you know, lost their entire family in a fire. And then they meet somebody who lost their partner in a fire.
Yeah. Yeah,
the person who lost their partner doesn't say, oh, well, now I'm not grieving anymore. Now that I know it could have been worse. Oh,
no.
I'm so grateful I only lost one.
It's not the way it works. Yeah,
right.
No. Okay, next one, fear. And fear is a big one, isn't it? In suicide. There, because there's so many fears, so many. Your fear of saying the wrong thing, your fear of putting another myth, right? Putting the idea in their heads. Your fear that it's going to or might happen. So we're kind of tiptoeing all the time around this person. And I'm going to read again from your book, an example of a boyfriend. And he said, I'm afraid that when my girlfriend talks about suicide, and I'm afraid when she doesn't, because she might be hiding what she's thinking. So that is so tough. You just don't know. You just don't know what to do. But there's so let's talk about this fear.
Yeah. I mean, there's fear of what you know and fear of what you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And what you don't know could be limitless. Like your mind can go through all these different possibilities and they may not be true at all, but it still gets your anxiety up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that you, one of the, because you do a lot of journaling, you suggest a lot of journaling throughout your book, right? And one of the tips that you give the person is, well, ask yourself this question, how have you coped with these feelings of fear before? So basically what works, right? What can help you in this moment? I love that tip. It's very important.
And it's, you know, borrowed from solution-focused therapy.
Uh-huh.
Solution-focused therapy asks, when is this problem not present? And so it's turning it a little around mm-hmm. to what have you done when this mm-hmm. problem is present mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. how has that helped you?
Yeah. Another one, rejection. That's huge too in suicide. And how many times have we heard this? And it's so close to fear. They come together many times, right? You feel rejected. How can you even think about leaving me, right?
And also, if you loved me, you know, I mean, I've had clients who lost somebody they loved to suicide and they say, why wasn't I enough?
Yeah.
If they loved me, why wouldn't they have stayed alive?
Mm-hmm.
It's looking at things through a different lens.
Mm-hmm. Through, and what would be that different lens?
Well, the person who's saying if they loved me, they would live, isn't seeing the world the same way as the person who is having suicidal mm-hmm. thoughts. And it was really rather staggering, Paula. I read an interview once with a mother who had a son who was suicidal, and he first started having suicidal mm-hmm. thoughts when he was like 7 or 8. And for his entire life, because he did end his life when he was, I believe, 19. Mm-hmm. So from then on until he died, he was always thinking about suicide and talking openly about it. And they were getting him help. Mm-hmm. They were doing everything they could. And he said to her one day when he was still very young, he said, you know, people say it's selfish if somebody kills themselves, but I think it's selfish if you want me to stay alive and suffer just so that you won't suffer.
Wow.
And when cool. I,
oh yeah. my goodness, to listen, to hear that from your son.
And I think he was like 9 or 10 when he said it, if I remember
what?
Correctly. Yeah.
Wow.
So I think, you know, somebody who says, if they loved me, they'd want to stay. Their view of the world is I don't know how to say this. I have a post on my website called "Is It Selfish to Die in a Tornado?" And I talk about how when somebody dies by suicide, people will say it was selfish. Not everybody, but some people will say it was selfish. And I compare it to a tornado. Like, well, but if somebody dies in a tornado, we don't say, oh, it was so selfish of them to get carried away by those winds. Or it was so selfish of them to not hold on tighter to the tree that they were clinging to. Yeah. You know, like we understand that the winds of a tornado are so fierce that it's stronger than not only the person, but anybody.
Yeah.
And so when people are applying the standard of, well, if they loved me, they'd stay, I think they're not recognizing the enormity of the tornado. You know, like the mental tornado that is happening.
Stacey, you were talking, and I thought the other day I read somewhere, I don't know where, because I read too much, but something that I hadn't thought about. It's when we talk about a person who died of suicide, we never consider and take into consideration the time that they lived with their pain and still chose to live. We define them by the moment they quote unquote gave up, right? But what about the years and years sometimes of treatment, of trying, of doing everything they can? That is kind of put in the trash and close the lid, right? And it kind of goes with that. So it's about empathy and putting yourself in their shoes and try to look at the big picture as well.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting you say that, because in my work with loss survivors, often what can be a turning point for some people is to recognize that they're focusing on when and how their loved one died, but not how their loved one lived.
Yes.
And so it's similar to what you're saying, except that when I've talked about this with loss survivors, we haven't talked about, I love this idea. I mean, I don't love the idea because it's sad and it's painful, but I think it's important to consider the idea that people have stayed alive despite pain for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Usually when I'm working with somebody about it, it's that they're reclaiming positive memories, you know, because the death has come to overshadow all the
takes over, right?
Yeah. And so then they're reclaiming, you know, the memories of the fun times and of the times they felt close and all of that. But it's also important to reclaim the memories of the hard times. Just like you're saying.
I think it's a great reframing for those who lost someone to suicide. Well, think about all the time they stayed alive.
Yes.
Despite the pain, right?
Yes.
Okay, so let's move on to another chapter, but I will just mention other states of mind or emotions that you mentioned: hopelessness, burnout, right? Embarrassment, confusion, depression, and one that I even wrote in capital letters here, trauma. Because we think about the trauma on the side of the person who is suicidal, but we don't actually think about us. We who live with someone who have suicidal thoughts, right? How traumatic that is, and how your nervous system is totally rewired. You are hyper attentive all the time, hyper focused on that person, always tiptoeing, always afraid of something. And that has an impact on your body. And it is trauma. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, even while you and I are talking about it, I'm realizing that I think a lot of times people discount their own needs. And so they may say, well, this isn't traumatic because I'm not, you know, like they may poo-poo it. Like, well, I shouldn't be this upset or I shouldn't be this affected, but it is traumatic. Anytime somebody that you care about has their life in danger, that is traumatic. Like, I mean, the definition of post-traumatic stress disorder, according to the DSM, the American Psychiatric Association, is that you or someone you care about have faced a threat to your life that wasn't from natural circumstances. Now, I would argue that trauma can also come from cancer or from, you know, other natural diseases. So I would diverge from the DSM in that way. But anytime you have to worry about survival or about the survival of someone you care about, that is fertile ground for trauma.
Do you have a friend or a loved one who struggles with suicidal thoughts, ideation, or even previous attempts? If you do, I have some information for you. I know that the situation is scary, and many times we want to do the best we can to help, but we don't know how. Over the course of my 15 years working in this field, I have learned how to address these issues, and that's what I want to share with you. And for that, I have just created an online course that will guide you step by step on how to sit down and have this difficult conversation. The course is called How to Help Suicidal People, and I purposely took a very straightforward approach so that when you finish, you will feel prepared to take action in a safe, non-judgmental, and compassionate way. You will learn about the mental state of a suicidal person, how it impacts the way they view their personal crisis, how to bring hope into the conversation, how to prepare yourself to listen to them, especially when they talk about their emotional pain, how to create a safety plan, how to assess their risk level, and much, much more. The course comes in 6 modules and it's all videos with very simple language and reading materials for quick reference. If you think that this course is for you, click on the link on my notes or go to my website, understandsuicide.com, and click on the course tab. There, you can also watch a free sample and have more information about the course. Thank you. Okay, we're going to chapter 3 now.
And I have to tell you, I just love, Paula, that you read it so attentively and that you're taking out little bits and pieces of it. That's just,
It was hard. As I said in the beginning, I had to stop at some point because I only have like 45, 50 minutes. This is going to take like 5 hours if I continue. So I just repeated the person. So managing your stress, fear, and guilt. So we talked about how you feel and how it affects you, but how can you manage that, right? And I love something that you said, and I think it speaks to maybe to the style of therapy that you provide, which is kind of a little bit like mine too. I like to challenge clients to reframe things because they come with all these preconceptions, all these ideas that I know this is what it is, right? What we call cognitive distortions. Yeah. And you mentioned them in your book beautifully, very easy to explain, or thinking errors. We call that thinking errors too. But you say challenge yourself because we all have cognitive distortions. So can you mention a few of them that happens in that situation?
Sure. And it all boils down to a phrase that I really like. I didn't make it up. I don't know who made it up because I've seen it in so many different places, but it's don't believe everything you think. Mm-hmm. And that most people take for granted that if they think something, then it's true. So when somebody has suicidal thoughts, let me use the example of a parent, because we brought that up earlier. Often there can be the cognitive distortion of personalization. This is my fault. They want to, they're thinking of ending their life because of me, because of something I did. And I mean, that's hard because there are things we do that upset people or anger people.
Disappoint people. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's the human condition. But that doesn't mean that we are responsible for their suicidal thoughts. It doesn't at all. So another cognitive distortion could be catastrophizing. Mm-hmm. And you see that in one of the anecdotes where this woman's teenage son doesn't come home from school on time. And he was supposed to be home a half hour ago. And now she's convinced he's dying somewhere on the side of the road, that he's tried to kill himself. But then she was able to kind of talk herself down after she and this is fictional, but in the scenario, she was able to talk herself down after she went to her therapy and was able to kind of soothe herself, you know, and kind of mm-hmm. say to herself what she would say to a good friend. Mm-hmm. You don't know this, mm-hmm. you know, you don't know that the worst case scenario is the real scenario. Mm-hmm. What do you need to do? You know, what can you do right now in this moment to tend to yourself and to tend to the situation? Mm-hmm. The cognitive distortion of all or nothing thinking.
That's a huge one, right?
Yes. And by the way, people who have suicidal thoughts also engage in these same cognitive distortions. So they may be thinking life is all bad. There's nothing good. And meanwhile, you care about the person and you may be thinking, oh, I've only done bad things to them. I haven't done anything good. You know, so that would be a cognitive distortion, or because they still have suicidal thoughts, that means I'm a failure, which would be a mix of all or nothing thinking and yes. personalization. Mm-hmm. So those are, that's a sample.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Emotional reasoning too, which is if you feel that it's true, that is so present.
That I think is probably one of the, I think that cognitive distortion alone keeps many, many therapists in business because people will have thoughts about the future is hopeless, therefore it is hopeless, you know, because I think it is true, or I disappoint the people I care about, therefore it's true. I disappoint the people I care about, not, keep having the thought that I disappoint the people I care about.
Yeah.
I wonder why I keep thinking that. And, you know, it kind of isn't taking into account the times I don't disappoint people. You know what I mean? Like a more balanced way of thinking. But our emotions, they don't look at both sides of the issue.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that you mentioned that. Let's give my listeners more tools on how do you challenge yourself? Because, of course, cognitive distortions, they're stuck in your brain, right? They're in your body. I mean, you've been doing this for years. So how do you challenge yourself and how do you bring yourself to question these beliefs? One of the tips you give is look for the evidence. What's the evidence? Right? What else? How can you help them? Okay. Because it's hard, especially the all or nothing. People who are all or nothing or black and white thinking, which is the same. It's hard because they're listening right now. They're going, no, you're wrong. Right? How do you question yourself when you're black and white? That's the hardest.
Or they say, oh my God, that's right. I always do that. I'm never going to be able to change. Always and never usually are all or nothing thinking. And I don't mean to make fun of if somebody's in a distressing state of mind, you know, that's.
I know, we know, Stacey, don't worry. Okay. But we have to have sense of humor. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing this work.
That's true. That's true. We would have trouble getting out of bed in the morning. But what can one do? I think about this. This is, I don't think I put this in the second book, but then I put it in different words, but the model, again, I didn't make this up, of catch, check, change, and change can also be challenge. So try to catch yourself in the cognitive distortion is the first step. The next is check. Is this a cognitive distortion or is it true? Like if somebody's having the thought of, oh my God, if I lose my job, I'm going to become homeless. Well, that's catastrophizing if they've got money in the bank or if, you know, they've got stable housing. But if they don't have any money and they're already behind on their rent, that's not catastrophizing at all.
No, it's true. Reality. Yeah.
Right. So if it's a cognitive distortion, then the next step would be to try to change or to challenge the thought. And if not changing the thought, then changing the way we respond to the thought, changing the power the thought has over us. If it's not a cognitive distortion, then the next step would be problem solving.
Of course, yeah.
Like, what do I need to do? And now, you know, this is going to sound so weird, Paula, and I'm kind of embarrassed because this is going to be on a podcast, but I don't remember everything I wrote.
Of course. No, I know. Sometimes people tell me, Paula, you wrote this on your book. I said, I did.
Isn't it weird?
I know. Oh, it's not weird at all. Believe me, I have interviewed quite a few authors and they say, oh, I wrote, actually, I don't know who it was that I mentioned something they said and they were, wow, that's good. I wrote that. Because for those of you who are listening, if you've never written a book, we get into a trance when we're writing. And I don't know, something takes over and we really do not remember everything. We remember the overall, but not everything. So you're fine, Stacey, you're fine. But I want to read something that you wrote. You did write it on this book. And you said, in my clinical practice, and it has to do with this cognitive distortion and how to challenge yourself. In my clinical practice, I've observed that unfairly holding ourselves responsible for something, though painful, can protect us from the even more painful recognition of just how random life is. I love that because it's us trying to control life, yes. Right? It's the sense of when you lose and nothing takes your control away from you, or the sense that you lost total control, then you're having someone you love be suicidal, right? Yeah. You totally lose control. You say, okay, now I'm done. And this is what cognitive distortions do. They give you a sense of control. This is what it is, and that's what I need to do. And sometimes it's not as easy. And you say, yeah, the alternative is terrifying.
Well, it is. And when I talk about this in class, I've had students ask me to stop talking about it because it makes them so anxious. Mm. I've had to be very mindful of how to talk about this very important and painful truth, mm-hmm. Without destabilizing it's my students.
Tough. Yeah.
But what it is if you can blame yourself, as painful as that is, if it's your fault it happened, then that means you can stop it from happening again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you blame yourself and you think that you have the power to stop this trauma from happening, whether it's that the person is thinking of suicide, whether it's they made an attempt, or mm-hmm. whether it's that they died by suicide. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you hold yourself responsible, then that means you can learn from your mistakes, and in the future it will never happen again.
Mm-hmm. So I get control. Yeah.
But sadly, that's not the reality.
I will give them another tip that comes from you, the one that you don't remember. So you say, ask yourself, how does it help me to keep telling this to myself? Is it helping me? And how does it hurt me? So that's a great tip.
And what I was thinking of there is, again, I'm going to give an analogy that's not about suicide, but I was thinking about a pregnant woman, and a woman who has been carrying a baby inside her for many months and is really eager to meet this child she's been carrying. And she could be telling herself all the things that could go wrong.
Hmm.
Between now and delivery or during delivery.
Wow.
There's plenty of stories out there that she could be telling herself, but it won't help her. And most mm-hmm. people, they recognize like, oh, I can't go down that rabbit hole or I may never come out. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to things like self-blame mm-hmm. or personalizing or holding ourselves responsible, we sometimes lose that filter. We don't recognize that it's a rabbit hole.
Yeah. And I interviewed a man called Jack Jordan. I don't know if you listen to this.
Oh, movie, yeah.
But yeah, I remember. He's such a sweet man. And one of the things that I remember he told me, it's funny because from all these interviews, the ones that I remember, I will remember one or two things that they said and that just glues to my brain. And it's glued to my brain. So he said something, and it has something to do with guilt, right? And you wrote, it can be hard to distinguish between blaming yourself unfairly and taking responsibility for a mistake. Because as you said, you might have hurt this person. Or let's say this happens, couples, one wants to leave. So they did it, or they're suicidal because I left. It's my fault. But again, you're doing, you know, it's your life. But he said something to me that really caught my attention. He said, Paula, with my clients, because he does family treatment for loss. So they already lost someone to suicide. And go, okay, and they come with all this guilt. It's all my fault. It's all my fault. And he'll say, okay, let's examine it. I'll hold your hand while we're going to go through a trial, right? I can go through that with you as long as you are, it promised me one thing, you're going to be fair. That's all I ask. So it's a good way, because it's not that you are responsible. Nobody's responsible for somebody's death, but you might have, of course, made a mistake. And you hold that responsibility as the whole reason why, right? But I like that idea. It's a trial. I'll be there with you. I'll sit with you. We'll go through it. I'll ask the difficult questions. You're going to have to process that. But the only thing I ask is be fair.
I love that, because it also brings to mind a quote that I've read in the cognitive therapy literature, which is that most of us have a prosecutor living in our head, and we don't have a defense attorney, you know, so the defense attorney ensures fairness.
Yeah. Well, we have to end this interview at some point. I want to end with the manipulation part.
Okay.
Because I think that's very common. It happens. And I've heard so many people. I have two last questions for you, because I think the last one is the number one questions, but we're going to the manipulation. So how do you tackle that? If you're going through a situation, and it happens a lot with teenagers, right? Oh, I think they just want attention. They're doing this to manipulate and get the car or get the iPhone or whatever, or to go out at night with their friends and go to the party or anything. So how do you handle that?
Yeah, it's hard, because ever present in your mind is the fear, well, if I say no, then they could kill themselves, you know? And so I gave the example in the book of the young man who didn't want to go to church. And he told his father, if I have to go to church this morning, I'm going to kill myself. And the father was able to talk with him about, well, what are you really trying to say here? You know, what's really going on? But there are many, many times where people worry, like, especially, I mean, you can think of, I keep talking about parents, let me shift a little to romantic relationships. Mm-hmm. If you break up with me, I'll kill myself. Yeah. If you leave me, you'll feel guilty the rest of your life, because I'll kill myself and it'll be your fault. Mm-hmm. And that is such a messy, messy situation for everybody, because on the one hand, it seems overtly manipulative, and in fact is considered a form of domestic violence in the domestic violence literature, that to tell somebody that you're going to kill yourself if they leave you is a way to try to have power over them and to control them and control their actions. Yeah. But what if that really is how the person feels? Mm-hmm. Like, what if the person really does feel, oh my God, if you leave me, then I won't have anything to live for, because, you know, they're describing their pain. I'm not saying it's right to say that to somebody, but I'm
saying, nobody can be real. Yeah.
Right. It can be their truth. Mm-hmm. And then both can be true. Mm-hmm. The person could be genuinely suicidal and
manipulating
or appearing to manipulate. Now, a point I make there's two really important points I make in that chapter. One is that just because you feel manipulated doesn't mean you're being manipulated.
That's great. Again, cognitive distortion.
Right. And then, exactly. And then the other one is, often when you do feel manipulated, it's not the person that's manipulating you. It's the danger, you know, that you feel.
It's the fear.
Right. It's the fear for the person's life that is making you feel like, well, I have to do this or else they'll get so upset that they'll kill themselves. Mm-hmm. And so it's the situation that is putting these walls around you and limiting your choices, not the person, and not necessarily the person. I mean, every now and then there are cases where, and I hate to say this because it's one of the myths of suicide, is that people don't mean it or that they're just manipulating. And I would say, you know, this isn't a scientific estimate at all, but just in my own experience, 99% of the time, that is not true.
No. Yeah.
But there is that 1%.
1%. Yeah. Yeah. So what you say is presume the danger is real. Connect with compassion and empathy. So doing what that that father did, right? Okay, so let's see, what is going on here? What are you really saying? What are you going through? Where's the pain, right? Track the pain. Focus on next steps. And the last one, and that's my last question, because it's a tough, and I'm sorry, it's a tough one to answer, I'm telling you already. Every time someone asks me that, oh no, not again. Okay, so stick to your limits, right? So know your limitation. Here's the question. What do you do when they don't want to be helped?
Oh,
that is so tough, isn't it, Stacey?
That...
You can do whatever. I mean, you can go read my book, read Stacey's book, all the books out there, take all the classes, do everything, follow the books, and still... it might happen because they'll say, no, I don't want to go to therapy. No, I don't want to be medicated if it's the case. No, I don't want this. And I don't, what do you do if they don't want to be helped?
Yeah. Oh, it's such a painful situation. And that's really the focus of the chapter, coping with conflict, because often there's conflict around, why won't you try, or why won't you go to a therapist, or why won't you do this or that, you know? Mm-hmm. And my overriding message is to try not to get into a power struggle, because if you're trying to persuade them why they should do something, then they're going to try to persuade you why they shouldn't. Hmm. But the ideal, and this is for motivational interviewing, the ideal is for us to be able to listen in such a way that they're able to get in touch with both sides of the issue. You know, so rather than one person arguing go and the other person saying no, if the person who says go instead says, so you don't want to go, seems like, you know, you really don't want to get help. And then that can open the door to the person exploring why they don't want to get help without it being an argument.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. Yes. It's helpful. And but again, it falls into this that you mentioned in these chapters. You have to recognize your limitations, right? There is a moment when you say, I can't. It's out of my hands now. I've done everything.
Well, and I have to tell you, I have an article on my website, and it's called You Can't Do Everything. Limitations in helping the suicidal person. I think it's something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a phrase in it that says, do everything you can, but know you can't do everything.
I love that.
And I realize
I'm gonna use it. I'm just asking for permission. I'm using it.
You may use it as much as you want. Do everything you can, but know you can't do everything. And what do you think that no means? Is that N-O or is it K-N-O-W? It works either way.
Yeah. And
I have to tell you that some people who have read that article, they've said to me, and I don't mean to be melodramatic or self-aggrandizing or anything like that, because I'm just the messenger in these situations, but they said to me, it changed my life, you know, because
you gave them freedom.
It liberated them from this expectation. And yet at the same time, it's also devastating. That you can't do everything. By and large, the people I speak with, they say, I hate that I can't do everything. I wish I could control the situation. I wish I could keep this person alive. But knowing that I can't and reminding myself that it's not all in my control liberates them from a sense of responsibility that is greater than they deserve.
Wow, I love that. Well, thank you so much, Stacey, for being here with us again. Get the book. So is the book out yet?
It's coming out January 3rd, and I'm very excited that it's going to be so accessible price-wise.
Oh, great. Because
my first book is for professionals, so you know how they... It's for professionals and students, so you know how they kind of... The publishers charge a whole lot for that.
Yeah.
But this book is for the general public. So right now, it's... I think it's listed at $20, but if you go to newharbinger.com, Last I checked, they were having a discount of like 25% off, even for pre-orders. And then on Kindle, it's $9.99. At least it was when I last checked.
That's perfect. I will have all the links below, and we are doing this interview now, and I will get it published in time for them. Well, I'll have the links to the book on Amazon and everything, and maybe the discount will still be around when I publish. But Stacy, thank you so much. I wish you all the success in the world with this book. I hope you get a lot of interviews out there, because people need help, and it's exhausting to be to have a loved one with suicidal thoughts. So I'm sure that they can, the book will help a lot of people. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me again.
You've been listening to Understand Suicide, the podcast of journalist and therapist Paola Fontanelli. If you've been touched by suicide and believe your story might help others, please consider contacting Paola through her website, understandsuicide.com.